Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
This book, Crooked, has been out 3 weeks. And the day that it came out, my agent called me. I think he was on a bus because it was awfully noisy. And he said, I just want to congratulate, oh my goodness, Comey. And we were watching it come up at simultaneously on our phones that Comey had been fired. Well, first of all, I had a little problem back here when I read that, when I saw that, but I also thought to myself, well, that's it. You know, the news cycle, come on in and try to sit up towards the front if at all possible. The news cycle is going to get completely caught up in James Comey and everything that's going to happen afterwards, Russia, the FBI, you name it. Every day holds some other upsetting thing, basically. And then I realized, well, it's terrible for me in terms of getting media, but everybody is going to have terrible back pain, so I guess we're going to sell a lot of books. And believe me, we have. So the radio shows have been really helpful, I think, in getting this front of mind for people. But I'm really glad that you're all here, and I'm going to read a little bit, and then we're going to have some questions. One of the questions that's always asked to me is, how did I come to spend 7 years writing this book? And my friend Rachel over there has known me for the whole 7 years. And she's watched me go through this process, it's like a dog trying to dig a hole, isn't it? Basically, it's like, okay, I got down about 6 inches. Let's see what's 6 more inches down. Let's see what's 18 inches down. Oh, good, now we're down 4 feet. And sometimes it's very hard to climb out of those holes, but the more I looked, the more I found, and the more I realized that the back pain industry, such as it is, really wasn't doing us any favors. I had my own issues with back pain for many years, starting when I was a teenager, and it was manageable until I was pregnant with my first son, at which point I went to my doctor and I said, what is this thing going down my leg? You know, what's the problem? She said, that's sciatica, that's normal, go away. It really never did go away, and then there was another child, and then there were 10-hour stints at my desk for years and years and years, and by the time my first book was published in 2007, I was in pretty lousy shape, and I decided that I was going to have to do something about it right away. And having been through physical therapy and all kinds of different exercises and joined a whole bunch of gyms and not gone to them, sound familiar? I thought, well, obviously I have to go see my primary care doctor, and he needs to write me an order for an MRI, and then once that's done, I'll go to see a surgeon, and we'll get this structural thing that must be wrong with me under control. And I went through that process, and I realized while I was going through it that there were a whole lot of questions about the validity of what was being offered. And as I got further into the research, I saw that I needed to help people set in context what was being offered to them so that they could make better decisions about what they were going to do in terms of dealing with their own pain. So that's how this book came to be, and I am now going to read to you from a chapter called Needle Jockeys. I should say that the book is set up, in two sections. The first part is called Problems, and the second part is called Solutions. So while you can read them in either order, because a lot of people who buy this book are just, I gotta find a solution, I gotta find it now, I can't worry about these problems. It's pretty important to understand what doesn't work, what there is no evidence for, how we're gonna waste not only our own personal money, but the government's money and the money that we pay out as working people. We pay it out every single week, and it should not be ill-used. It should not be used for purposes that do not help people, and in fact, as you are about to hear, often harm them. So we're still bringing more people in. I should know with this group that that would be the case. In New York, I had to. I just came back from doing a bunch of events in New York, and in New York, it's extremely common because of the way buildings are built that in a bookstore, the room like this is either downstairs or upstairs, and there's no elevator. So I would arrive, and they would say, "Okay, you're going to be downstairs," and I'd look down this flight of stairs that. You know, I could barely imagine if I had a half a glass of wine, I probably couldn't negotiate that. And I said, we're going to have a lot of people here who can't use the stairs. So on two occasions, the staff had to move something like 100 chairs from downstairs to upstairs just to accommodate people. It was very crowded, but at least everyone could hear. So let's go with needle jockeys. Now, I should tell you that a needle jockey is someone who gives epidural steroid injections for a living and other kinds of interventional pain management. Do we have any needle jockeys in the room? I always like to check. Okay. How epidural steroid injections can go wrong. Near my office, there's a breakfast and lunch joint where strangers sit down at shared tables. When Joseph, an attorney in his early 70s, heard that I was writing a book about the back pain industry, he started asking questions. That afternoon, he was scheduled to have the first of three epidural injections meant to relieve the symptoms of spinal stenosis, a condition in which the spinal cord narrows to the point where it squeezes the nerves. The weakness and cramping in his legs were so bad that he couldn't walk a long city block without stopping to recover. The injections were his best hope, he said, making it even harder for me to break the news. A few months earlier, in a 2015 review of the medical literature, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality had found no evidence that epidural steroid injections were effective in treating symptoms of spinal stenosis or typical low back pain. Even in the presence of a recent disc herniation and ensuing sciatica, the benefits of injections were small and not sustained over time. That news followed on the heels of an FDA statement warning that injections of the active medication in these shots, glucocorticoids, a class of corticosteroids, into the epidural space of the spine could result in rare but serious neurological problems, including loss of vision, stroke, paralysis, and death. Based on those and other findings, the Journal of the American Medical Association advised physicians to refrain from recommending injection therapy to patients with any kind of chronic pain. That news did not go over well with the doctors known as interventional pain physicians, who make a living performing such procedures. In the United States, more than 10 million epidural steroid injections are delivered each year, a number that makes them the bread and butter of interventional pain management practices. I was not surprised that my lunch partner didn't have the facts. Primary care physicians who ordered the shots were rarely informed about the lack of evidence and the risk of treatment. Even young, healthy people, explained anesthesiologist James Rathmill, the chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Boston Brigham and Women's Hospital, could go in with manageable low back pain symptoms, and come out with catastrophic neurological injuries. The bottom line, said Rathmell, is that if you come into my clinic with chronic axial back pain, you're not going to get epidural steroid injections because they don't work. People should get the best evidence-based treatment they can, he added. As a rule of thumb, if you pay practitioners to do stuff, they will do more stuff. frankly, that's what's happened in interventional pain management. It's just a microcosm of what's happened in all of medicine. You have to excuse me because I have a slightly runny nose, and I'm going to have to do this periodically. It's allergies. Thank you. As I explained these things to Joseph, he paled. Why would his doctor advise him to undergo a worthless and risky procedure? 3 decades ago, anesthesiologists had no trouble getting jobs in hospital ORs. On a busy morning, they could run 5 cases at once and get paid for them all, while depending on registered nurses to keep an eye on individual patients. Starting in the early 1990s, cost-conscious health management organizations, HMOs, realized that the nurses could manage without supervision, and they stopped paying fees to doctors who were at best marginally present. Many anesthesiologists found themselves underemployed. They knew little about treating musculoskeletal disorders or how to address the feelings of depression, anger, and isolation that often afflict back pain patients. But when they retooled, they set up pain management practices. Torpedoed into entrepreneurship, the most successful interventional pain physicians offered an ever-expanding menu of injections, including facet and sacroiliac joint blocks, selective nerve blocks, discography, needle electromyography, radio frequency and thermal facet ablation, botulinum toxin, and trigger point injections. They implanted intrathecal drug delivery pumps and spinal cord stimulators and cemented together vertebral compression fractures. They used medical lasers to heat, shave, and slice soft tissue. By the turn of the new millennium, interventional pain management, which a decade before had barely existed, had become one of the most profitable aspects of spine care. There are indeed people who undergo one perfectly targeted epidural steroid injection and hit the golf course the next morning completely cured. In the more typical scenario, however, the first injection, if in fact it provides any relief at all, is only briefly effective. Then the numbing medicine and the anti-inflammatory effect of the glucocorticoid wear off and the pain returns. Generally, the shots are ordered in a series of 3, although no expert I asked could say why, and the American Society of Anesthesiologists guidelines do not advise the administration of a specific number. You always do 3, even if the first 2 do no good at all, wisecracked neurosurgeon Charles Burton, who publicly questioned the safety and effectiveness of the procedure long before JAMA and the FDA got on board. Some doctors construed the rule of 3 to mean that in a single visit, they could give 3 shots at each affected area, a vertebral level, thereby exposing a patient to a colossal dose of glucocorticoid. In fact, when Colorado researchers mined an insurance company's database, they found that one doctor had billed a single patient for 51 such injections in 1 year. The same database showed that a New Jersey patient had received 13 shots in a 5-month period and had subsequently developed kidney failure. The FDA had been issuing cautionary statements about epidural steroid injections since 1981. But in 2014, the agency took a further step, compelling pharmaceutical manufacturers that produce the injectable glucocorticoids to clearly state the risks on every vial's label, advising that serious neurological events, some resulting in death, have been reported with epidural injection, and that the safety and effectiveness of epidural administration of corticosteroids has not been established. The FDA stopped short of requiring manufacturers to notify physicians or their purchasing departments that things had changed, and most did not notice. One pain physician, Cleveland Clinic's Richard Rosenquist, told Bloomberg reporter David Armstrong that because he'd used such drugs for his entire career, unless he was alerted to do so, he was unlikely to go back and spend time reading the package insert. The implications were significant. Properly consented, a patient who was about to receive an epidural steroid injection would hear about specific risks, including damage to the dura mater, the sturdy sleeve surrounding the spinal cord, nerve root injury, elevated cholesterol levels, vertebral fractures, the death of muscle and bone tissue, staph infection, epidural abscess, immune system deficits, stroke, and death. But in reality, if this information was conveyed at all, it was in boilerplate format, which the patient signed only after a cursory glance. There are two dominant techniques for we're not going to do that. That's very, very technical. We're going to go to the beginning of another chapter right now. And this chapter is about my little trip down to Southern Florida to a minimally invasive spine surgery clinic. So let me just get there and we will start from that. Good so far? Are we horrified yet? Okay. All right. So this chapter is called Google Your Spine Surgery. The truth about cutting edge procedures as advertised online and on TV. In the spring of 2008, when I began looking for a solution, I knew nothing of the mayhem I have just described. Obviously, I have just described a lot of mayhem. I was still convinced that surgery was the way to go, and I was determined to find the best surgeon in the business, even if it meant traveling to another city. My husband, a big sports fan, did some research and discovered that down in Marina del Rey, near Los Angeles, eminent orthopod Robert Watkins III was the spine guy for Joe Montana, Peyton Manning, Wayne Gretzky, and Dwight Howard. With some of the highest earning athletes in the world as his patients, he could not afford to make mistakes. To my surprise, it took just a few weeks to get an appointment with Watkins. In June, on the short flight south, I carried my yellow envelope of scans and a stack of completed medical forms that had been sent from his office. One of those forms included a coloring book outline, front and back, of a human figure. As directed, I'd drawn dashes to identify areas of numbness, circles for pins and needles, cross hatches for burning sensations, slash marks for stabbing pain, and plus signs for aching. Accordingly, the lower right quadrant of my low back was tattooed black with cross hatches. Slashes stumbled down the right buttock, hip, and thigh, and then trickled to speckles from the knee down to the foot. Within moments of my arrival at the Marina Spine Center, Robert Watkins III, white-haired and gently self-assured, joined me in the exam room. I told him about my rounds of physical therapy and why in the past I'd avoided spinal injections. When he asked what prescription drugs I was taking, I said I took a leave and stayed away from painkillers because I could not afford to have a fuzzy mind. After he performed a hands-on exam, checking my range of motion, gait, reflexes, and motor strength, Watkins sent me over to the hospital for a CT scan of my facet joints to see if inflammation there might be causing the pain. He said that his office would be in touch with the results and handed me a note to give to the security detail at the airport, where the radioactive dye that remained in my body after the scan would be likely to set off alarms. In a few weeks, he said, I should plan to return to Marina del Rey for more tests, including discography and electromyography. I left with a feeling that I was in exceptionally good hands. Regrettably, that call never came. Every couple of days, I telephoned the office, only to be shuttled to a voicemail recording that answered the call by chirping, prescription drug line. In mid-July, Watkins said that his assistant would schedule my diagnostic procedures in Los Angeles immediately. A few days later, as I headed for the airport, anxious to get the show on the road, That assistant let me know that the electromyography machine was broken and my appointment had been canceled. I rescheduled only to learn less than 24 hours before I was supposed to arrive that Watkins had canceled the day, evidently because one of his athletes was in duress. Beyond that, because 2 months had slipped away since my initial visit, my health plan's pre-approval for the diagnostic procedures had expired, and Watkins' office would have to obtain these again. Exasperated, I told the receptionist that I'd be in touch when I returned from a 2-week, multi-city speaking gig. I should have been eager, but frankly, it was hard to think of anything beyond the thudding pain in my back and hip, and how much worse it was going to get when I was on the road. Robert Watkins is a leader in his field, a highly respected conventional spine surgeon, which means that he sticks with well-accepted protocols and avoids faddish procedures. But as I was about to discover, there were other options. As my plane took off for Philly, an ad featuring a bikini-clad woman on a beach, a Band-Aid stuck to the small of her back, grabbed my attention. The copy read, "Just 2 weeks ago, I had back surgery. Thank you, Laser Spine Institute." Reading further down the page, I learned that 97% of patients recommended this safe, fast, and apparently bloodless, minimally invasive procedure, which took less than an hour. Apparently, you could expect to get your life back immediately. As soon as I was on the ground, I found a wireless connection and went directly to Laser Spine Institute's website. Happy patients at LSI's facility in Tampa, Florida, waxed euphoric, including their full names and hometowns in their endorsements. Patients had to be incredibly impressed to be willing to do that, I reasoned, feeling my journalist's customary skepticism ebb away. Laser Spine Institute described itself as the premier healthcare provider in spinal surgery. Physicians there employed a wide variety of laser-assisted techniques performed while the patient was, quote unquote, under local anesthetic. The Band-Aid on the woman on the beach covered only 1 3-millimeter incision at the surface. Naively, I reasoned that an incision that small meant that the disruption of the bones and soft tissue beneath the skin was also minimal. Desperate for a solution, and just as LSI's direct-to-consumer marketers hoped that I would, I picked up the phone. So, that gives you just a general taste of the whole situation here. Want to see the scar from the... It's that big. What I learned there, well, I recommend you buy the book, oddly enough. But essentially, I learned that minimally invasive surgery, and we've all seen it advertised, and you know, we've all kind of wondered about it. Maybe some people in the room have had this. All this discussion of lasers, this is just sexy buzzwords. There is the damage to the body beneath the skin is exactly the same damage that you have in a conventional surgery. There is no difference, except for it's much, much more difficult to perform spine surgery while looking at a monitor and doing everything backwards. So a lot of things go wrong. A lot of things went wrong for a lot of people there. And of course, you can read about it. So I think I'm going to open it to questions now, unless somebody really needs to. Okay, well, we've already talked about something, but so let's see some hands. Go ahead. Do you want to take the mic over there?
We're podcasting.
Oh, we're podcasting. Okay, good to know. I'll stop stumbling over my words now.
Okay, the question I have is, have you heard about prolotherapy, and is it effective for back pain?
I have heard about prolotherapy. I spent some time in the outskirts of Chicago in Oak Park with somebody who sells prolotherapy. And I say sells because there is no value to it. Effectively, it's an injection of either salt water or sugar water. The point of it is to create inflammation in the area and then to spur healing. There's absolutely no evidence, and it is not endorsed in any set of respectable guidelines at all. I would take that one right off the list, unfortunately. Okay, so come on, let's not be shy. I know you have tons of questions. How about back there? Come sit down.
Have you ever heard of Esther Gokhale and
Yes, I have. And I spend time with Esther down in Menlo Park, and she has a very interesting program. Her philosophy, which I would not want to describe for her because she has a really nice book out that describes it really well, is that we all need to reassume a more primitive position, that we've lost a lot of the curves in our backs, in our back from sitting so much, et cetera, and that if we do, back pain will pretty much go away. Now, I have heard some people really endorse that, but everything I have read and everything I understand suggests that that is not going to fix a problem, that substantial exercise and changes in the way that muscles are balanced will be necessary, because you can't correct posture by saying, I'm going to sit up straight, because next, who's tried this? I'm going to sit up straight. The next thing you know, you're back to where you were, right? You've slid out of your chair. Your pelvis is in at a triangular position to the back of your chair. It doesn't really work by thinking. It has to work by drilled motor patterns that become ingrained over time. As I say, Esther has had a lot of success, and she has developed a whole sort of, I don't know if they're franchises, I'm not quite sure how it's structured from a business perspective, but she's moved this out all over the country and all over the world, and, you know, anybody who can get better, I'm all for it, you know. For me personally, I didn't like it for me, and that's all I can really say about it, but a lot of people do, so go ahead. Pink shirt needs a mic, right?
What are your thoughts on fusion?
Well, my thoughts on fusion are not so good. As we might have noticed, Tiger Woods has had a little problem in the last week or so. He's certainly not the exception. The success rates are very, very low. And when we say success in this context, what we mean is not going water skiing and playing basketball. When a surgeon talks about a success, what he means, and I say he, because there are very few female spine surgeons in this country, which shows that women are smarter than men. When he says it's a success, it means that he's looked at it on the x-ray and the bones have fused together. What fusion involves, okay, so we may need a little structural lesson here. You know that there are vertebrae in the spine, and you know that they're stacked on top of each other, and you know that in between them is a little padded disc. It's a bit like, you know those gummy jellies we used to get when we were kids? Texturally, it's a little softer than that, but that's a generally good idea. And that disc, everyone's always talking about a slip disc. They don't slip. Let's just wipe that out of our vocabulary now. They cannot slip. They are very strongly anchored. I've sat in an OR, stood actually in an OR, during several surgeries, including fusion surgery, and I've watched a surgeon try to get that disc out between from between the vertebrae, because that's necessary generally, and it's violent. I mean, we've got a giant screwdriver, and they're going bam, bam, and pieces are flying out. Well, then some pulverized bone is put in between, and the two vertebrae are put together, usually with a plate, screws, etc. And what happens is, well, the movement is over at that level, yes? So the other levels are under high demand, every other level, up and down, under much more demand. And what happens is that we get something called adjacent segment deterioration. And that is why you hear of people going back and back and back for for more surgery. And I'm sure we've all heard of that. You know, he's had two, he's had three. Well, the outcomes after one are pretty terrible, and after two, three, and four, they are horrible. So unfortunately, fusion surgery has been on the rise since the mid-80s. Interestingly, that happened concurrently with the prescription of opioids. So I think that there is some collusion between surgeons, hospitals, and pharmaceutical makers, because after fusion surgery, people are nearly always given opioids because they need them. They're in a lot of pain, and very frequently they never get off them afterwards. Many people are still on painkillers years later. So you're going to ask the next question, reasonably enough, is, you know, I'm in a ton of pain. What am I supposed to do about it? My doctor said, well, I could do a fusion. Well, it's a high-risk operation, and the older you are, the higher risk it is. And unless you are in extraordinary physical shape, it's a really high-risk operation. The rehab period for it is at least a year. Really makes you wonder. By the way, it's inconceivable that Tiger Woods would be out driving a car like 3.5 weeks after his surgery. I don't know how he got out of there and got in a car and drove away, but that would not be something you could do because you absolutely cannot turn around behind you. So the rehab period is long. It takes months and months. And in those same months, it's been discovered in multiple studies, people can go through intensive exercise programs and end up in at least as good shape as they would have been if they had the fusion and then went through the rehab period. So any physician who doesn't endorse a very long structured rehab is really not doing you any kind of favor. Now, who here has been to physical therapy? Okay, who here, who here has not been to physical therapy? Okay, we got a few people who haven't been. Who here has spent, say, more than 4 sessions with a chiropractor? Okay, almost everyone, all right. So chapter 2 of my book is called Tale of Two Tables. And the first part of it is about chiropractic, and the second part of it is about physical therapy. Now, I like to start this part of the conversation by saying many, many chiropractors have left conventional chiropractic practice and moved into intensive exercise and rehab. And guess what? They're really good at it, because often people become chiropractors are very physically fit and they're very into the body, and they can be retrained effectively as instructors for this particular type of patient, the particular type of exercise. So it is quite possible to find someone with that DC after his or her name and have that person not crack you and not talk about subluxations and not want to x-ray you and definitely not want to see you twice a week for the rest of your life. Yeah? So that's a kind of, if you are looking for exercise therapy, or you're looking, and that's what you want, I never would say do not go to a chiropractor, because many of them have absolutely sworn off these traditional measures. If a chiropractor wants to adjust you regularly over a long period of time and tells you things like this will prevent your back pain from coming back, or this will keep you, I've heard chiropractors say, you know, this is the only way I'm going to keep you out of a wheelchair. If you hear that, that's not true. The one thing that a chiropractor may end up doing is, in fact, putting you in a wheelchair. And I found quite a few examples, and they're discussed in the book, of people who had such bad experiences that in some cases they are paralyzed, and in some cases there were strokes. No matter what happens, don't let anyone near you, don't let them near your neck. Do not ever have your neck cracked, and after you read the book, you'll know why. When we move on to physical therapy, of course, there are amazing physical therapists out there. But there are also corporate physical therapy clinics where usually those are the ones that your insurance pays for. So your doctor says, you know what, I'm going to send you to physical therapy, and here is the awesome thing about this. Your insurance is going to pay for it. And you usually say, oh my God, that is great. I feel so much better now already. But very often these are corporate clinics. And what you get there is one doctor of physical therapy, a DPT, and a whole bunch of assistants who have very minimal educations and very minimal experience. And they hand you a sheet of stick figures and say, these are your exercises, please do them. And you say, okay, and then you don't do them. And then they put you in a table and you get electrical muscle stimulation. You get hot packs, you get cold packs. You know, you might get some other types of therapy on the table. Well, guess what? There's no evidence whatsoever for the hot packs, the cold packs, or the electrical stim. All that time you spend relaxing there, and even when you take a nice nap up there, absolutely useless in terms of getting your back functional again. Now, there are other types of physical therapists, and I was very lucky to find one. It's not so hard to find one. You look for DPT OCS, which is orthopedic clinical specialty. And they almost are always independent practitioners. They usually don't take your insurance, which is just a horrifying thought, except for you have to consider what the opportunity costs of not getting better are. I mean, you can go to physical therapy 5 times, and your insurance will pay for it, but you're still not better, so that was just a waste of time, right? A physical therapist with the proper training usually works or in a very small practice or alone, and will enforce exercise. And the one that I saw and that I liked so much, he said to me, all right, he said, he looked me over, he did some manipulation, and he said, okay, on the mat. And I immediately sent me into exercises that I certainly didn't think I could do or would ever want to do. And he said, you're going to do them, and if you don't do them, I will release you from my care, and I will know if you're doing them. Because if you come back here and you're not quite sure how to do this thing you're supposed to be doing twice a day for the next 10 days, and you don't know how to do it, I'm going to know that you didn't do it. And so I did it, you know. And that's really where I found that I started to get better. And when he felt I was doing well enough, and that was just in a couple of weeks, he said, I'm going to refer you to an exercise specialist that I work with. She won't hurt you. She will push you. And she and I will be talking to each other. So sometimes I think you need you need some guidance, and you need a little bit of a threat. A little bit of a threat is better than some sugar sweet assistant who says, oh, does that hurt? Well, you should probably stop, because I'm going to get fired if you don't stop. So there is a trend, and I've had physical therapists mention it to me now in comments they've written to me. Literally, there are surgeons who are invested in these corporate physical therapy practices, and the thing that they want the physical therapist to do is fluff the patient, quote unquote, fluff the patient. Don't hurt the patient. Keep the patient there till the patient fails physical therapy a couple times. Then we can do some surgery, because the insurance company will pay for it. I don't want to give away the whole book, so let's have another question. Oh, gosh, let's go over here. Now, you want to do back there. That's fine. We'll get to you next. You're there. Oh. Either way, doesn't matter.
You mentioned sciatica as one of your problems. Did you find that was fixed by your surgery, or was there some other technique?
No, it was not fixed by my surgery. Now, sciatica is kind of a misunderstood term. We know that there's a sciatic nerve. Everyone knows that, right? It exits the spine at L4-5, which is about this height over here. And it runs down, it runs through the pelvis, it makes a nice trip through the thigh muscle. And when a person has a suddenly herniated disc, which is a fairly unusual thing to have. If you had one, you know it, because you stand up and you have a shot of pain down your leg. It wasn't there 4 minutes ago, and generally it won't be there 3 weeks later, because the nature of a disc herniation is that the material in the disc kind of oozes out, it presses on a nerve, the nerve gets all worked up because this type of biology is not supposed to be pressing on it, and it knows. Everything inflames. 3 weeks later, it's all gone. You walk away, you're fine. Now, there's this much more enduring kind of sciatica, right? And that is often has nothing to do with a disc herniation, although if we do an MRI on everyone in this room and everyone in every other room here, everyone will have something that looks like a disc herniation. But the pain that we know as sort of chronic sciatica generally has much more to do with the muscles in the area contracting around the nerve, which in fact runs all the way down. It branches off here and there, but it runs all the way down. So there are plenty of places for muscles to be contracted. And often people think, oh, my muscles are tight. Well, yes, but they're also weak. And they're trying very hard to do a job they're not supposed to be doing. And that is what causes that contraction. So when we're able to build enough structure around the rest of the body, then this part of you is no longer frantically trying to hold you up. And that kind of that area begins to relax and operate in a way that it is supposed to. And generally the sciatica goes away, and that is in fact what happened for me. I don't have it anymore. Let's see, there was going to be, okay, you have to go back to the lady in the pink now, because we didn't get to her.
All right.
Okay. Don't worry, I didn't forget about you. I'm keeping an eye on you back there.
I just wanted to ask, beyond exercise, what did work for you eventually?
Well, certainly exercise was key, and very specific types of exercise. I would say that we have a terrible misunderstanding about what the core is. Everyone is sure, because you've been in Pilates classes and they say, you know, tighten your core, suck in your belly, tighten your core. We are all under the impression the core is somewhere here. That is incorrect, actually. The core is everything from about the middle of your thigh all the way up here, and could, in fact, be considered to include some of these larger muscles in your back. And all of those muscles need to be strengthened and balanced. Now, not everyone is in a position to get into that kind of an exercise program. And so in the book, I write about some other options. And one of the best for people who have become deconditioned or perhaps older is something called Feldenkrais. Has anyone heard of it? Okay, if you're in any place else in this country, you say Feldenkrais, no one knows what you're talking about. So yay, Berkeley, right? So Feldenkrais is a movement program. It's very gentle, it's very simple, but it gets you out of movement patterns that are not serving you well. It can be done in a class. It's very inexpensive to take those classes. Kaiser runs those classes, if you're a Kaiser member. The Y often has them. They're all over and growing really fast in popularity. And you won't get hurt in there. And you will start to move. And you will feel better. And there's a man who's a friend of mine, and he's in his mid-70s, and he called me and he said, I've got to have surgery. I said, Howard, you're in your mid-70s. That's not necessarily going to be a walk in the park. He said, I know. He said, I got this pain running down my leg, and I can't move. And my doctor did an MRI, and he said, I have terrible, severe spinal stenosis, and I have no alternative. And whenever I hear someone say, I have no alternative to surgery, I know that something has gone wrong in translation, because it's not ever going to be the answer. It's not as if you have tried all these other things, then surgery will be the answer, because that is not how this works, in fact. As, you know, Tiger Woods would probably be the first to tell you. And, you know, Steve Kerr did not have a spinal fusion. He had what is called a microdiscectomy, but Steve Kerr had a press conference, and he said, and I do not quote exactly, stay the hell away from surgery. Don't let anyone in there. Rehab, rehab, rehab. You can just imagine what was going on in spine surgery ORs all over the country the next morning. So for someone who cannot get into an exercise program right now, Feldenkrais is a great option. Another amazing option is Tai Chi. I'm sure probably a lot of people have done Tai Chi here. And as you get older, it's something that I'm really interested in, because eventually the time is going to come when I don't want to push some weights around, you know? It's just not going to be fun anymore for me. And so it's something I'm very interested in, and it seems to have amazingly good effect on getting rid of back pain. I think the reason is that it really focuses on balancing your muscles. And it's also very good for your mind. And people who suffer from back pain often have high levels of anxiety, feel very isolated. Often there's a lot of anger involved. And Tai Chi seems to have that wonderful meditative quality. But it's work, you know? It's amazing. You come out of a Tai Chi class and you're tired, and it doesn't look like you did anything. So those things are very good. Meditation is also a positive. And then we have to talk a little bit about cognitive behavioral therapy, because you probably all know what that is too, which is they don't know that in the rest of the country either. But cognitive behavioral therapy is effectively changing the way that you frame a problem that you're having. So instead of saying, you know, I heard my chiropractor told me that if I took the groceries out of the car, I could break in half. I've heard that. Or I can't travel anymore because it's too dangerous for me. To reappraise this, and there are cognitive behavioral therapists who are now working in conjunction with exercise therapists to help people get through what the behavioral psychology folk refer to as fear-avoidant behavior, where you're so afraid to do anything that you're basically falling apart, you just have stopped moving, and catastrophizing, which is this notion of, if I do this thing, something absolutely terrible will happen to me. Typically, that is just not the case. And that is something that is a pervasive problem for people with chronic back pain. They are convinced that everything they do will make them worse. And that's just not the case. I have maybe how much more time? Acupuncture. Interesting. Acupuncture is starting to get some attention in spine medicine now. It certainly wasn't when I started writing this book, but I think with opioids on the skids, so to speak, acupuncture is starting to look a lot better. Now, what I spent some time in Boulder with an acupuncturist who's very well known for orthopedic problems, which is not generally what acupuncture is used for. And he does something called dry needling. Now, this looks vaguely like acupuncture, but believe me when I tell you, it does not feel like acupuncture. It feels as if you are having a drill bit driven into your skin. It is not comfortable, but it does seem to have a positive effect on a lot of people. I watched a woman just out on the table. I've been some really weird places in the past 7 years. Naked, of course. And he is putting needle, turn, needle, turn, needle, turn. And they're not small. And he has great success doing that. Now, in terms of what we know more as traditional Chinese medicine acupuncture, or the Japanese acupuncture, which is slightly different. Basically, this really picks up the endorphin level in the body. It causes, it does seem to reduce inflammation. And I think it's really worth it. But it's not ever going to work without the exercise program in concert. You will get off the table, you will feel a little better, you will go home, you will assume all the same habits you had before, and you will be right back where you started. So those things have to work together. There is no hands-on modality that will solve your problems. You have to do it yourself, usually, unfortunately, under supervision, because back pain patients, probably more than any other kind of patient, we cheat. We cheat so bad because we have very weak muscles and things hurt. And we're very quick studies, so we say, okay, there's that exercise. I'm going to do that exercise, and I'm going to do it without using any of the muscles that I'm supposed to be using for that exercise. And unless you have someone there, and for me, I'm not really an athlete, and I'm not that coordinated, and I don't catch on all that quickly. So I needed a lot of repetition. I needed someone to say, your hips are totally out of whack. They're not flat. They have to be flat, or you won't be getting anything from this exercise. You could actually be making yourself worse doing it the way you're doing. And I had, the second half of the book, as I say, is all about solutions, and we go from one practitioner to another, seeing what they have to offer. It's very exciting stuff, actually. But very often I learned that something I'd been doing for years was totally useless. People always say to me, oh, I do crunches every morning. Well, crunches are not good for low back pain, not at all. And I recommend that, you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm an investigative reporter, but every single practitioner who knew what he's talking about, or she, said, no crunches. Crunches are out of the question. We do not do sit-ups, for sure. We do not do forward bends when we're not flexible. Now, the idea in yoga, I'm sure practically everyone in here has done yoga, and, you know, forward bends are a big part of it. And when your pelvis is sufficiently flexible that you can actually tilt it, a forward bend is a lovely thing. But for most of us, people with low back pain especially, that's not the case. And so we do this thing. It looks like a forward bend. But meanwhile, everything is coming right out of the SI joints, and they are coming apart. And so much pain evolves from those types of activities. I love yoga. I like Iyengar yoga, which is known as the orthopedic yoga. I like it a lot. And there's a very good Iyengar Institute here in Berkeley, or maybe it's in Albany, I'm not sure, but it's very near here. And you need a yoga instructor who is going to watch you like a hawk if you have a back pain problem. And you have to stay out of a competitive environment. You may not be in a class where you are trying to keep up with the Joneses, because that will hurt you. And one of the people in my book, this great 40-ish guy, very handsome, very fit, and I'm like, what's wrong with you? He said, well, it was mostly my girlfriend. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, she wanted me to go with her to yoga, and, you know, we all got into this pose, and I really couldn't do it, so I just used my muscles to pull my leg across. And he was, you know, he's 5 years later, he's still not going to yoga classes. He thinks that it's, you know, very, very risky for him. It doesn't have to be risky, but you need a teacher who's really got the smarts, and a lot of them don't. You can get certified as a yoga teacher in a week. You can get certified as a personal trainer through the mail. You can get certified as a Pilates instructor in a weekend, just because someone, you have to watch those certifications. And in my book, I talk about what organizations and associations are legit and which ones are absolutely not. And you see these people, they have a string of letters after their names, right? What do they mean? Who knows? And you need to find, if you have the book, or even if you don't want the book, you can go to my website, and I have a very robust resource section, all free, you can find that information there, because I think it's very important for us to know what we're getting into. Well, I'll meet you down there. I ask only one thing, please. I am not that great at signing complex things and talking to you at the same time. So for the sake of your book signing, you know, you can easily go on my website. You can email me. A lot of ways to get in touch with me. But try not to ask me detailed questions while I'm signing, okay?
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.